where I've been and who I am, all the ways I've grown.
This isn't self-help, it's a full-on rebirth. Welcome to Girl Wake Up, the podcast for women who are done playing small, staying silent, or living by rules they never wrote. I'm Amy Polacco, journalist, divorce and life coach, and freedom warrior, and I'm here to help you take your power back. Because the system isn't going to save us. We need to save ourselves. So grab your coffee, your courage, and maybe a few curse words. It's time to wake up. Welcome to Girl Wake Up, everyone. Betrayal doesn't just break your heart. If you've been through it, like I have, you know, it can break your sense of reality. When the person you trust most is the one deceiving you, it's not just painful, it is trauma. I want to validate that for you today. And too many women are told to minimize it. Today, we're talking about betrayal trauma, what it is, why it hits so deeply, and how to begin healing with a national expert on this, Dr. Jill Manning. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Amy. It's really a delight and honor to be here.
I'm honored to have you here. I want to tell everyone about your background. For over two decades, Dr. Jill Manning has been a leading voice in the fields of sexual betrayal, compulsive sexual behavior, and the impact of internet pornography on marriages and families. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist, certified clinical partner specialist, EMDRIA certified EMDR provider, and board certified telemental health provider who specializes in helping betrayed partners heal and reclaim a sense of safety and stability in their primary relationships. She's the author of What's the Big Deal About Pornography and regularly develops digital resources designed specifically for betrayal trauma recovery. In addition to her clinical practice, she hosts monthly two-day intensives, working one-on-one with betrayed adults from across the U.S. and Canada. She's based in Colorado. She's also actively engaged in advocacy efforts to protect youth. I think that's so important as the mom of a 17-year-old son. Protect them from online pornography, bringing both research and real-world experience to her work. First of all, before we delve into the betrayal trauma, Dr. Manning, you know, you had a pretty powerful wake-up call yourself in your career, right, as a therapist that changed the trajectory of your professional life. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Certainly. First, thank you again for having me on. So I had graduated with my master's program in Canada, had started clinical work. And what was significant about that was in my training, I had actually been at a very top-notch training center for my internship that was focused on human sexuality. And yet nothing was mentioned at the time. And this is dating me somewhat, probably more so than the program. Nothing was mentioned about internet pornography in that training. And yet within 3 weeks of being out in real world practice, I had clients as young as 5 in kindergarten being referred and up to the age of 85 dealing with pornography related issues. They had discovered a partner or spouse or had found the pornography for this little one. The 5-year-old had found the pornography of a sibling stuffed under a bed mattress. And in that work, and as I was getting my bearings, as I started asking more questions, I realized that this really truly had become the wallpaper of our lives, that so many people were impacted and so many people were being increasingly betrayed through digital means.
That's changed,
it's changed things radically.
Now you can just, you know, get something up on your phone in a matter of minutes. You could take it with you. It's not like 30 years ago.
Well, and I think it's broadened the definition of what it means to cheat and what betrayal means. And so the wake-up call that really transitioned my career into focusing on these issues specifically was being referred to siblings, a male and female sibling. And long story short, discovering through careful assessment that they had been used in the production of pornography. There was something that switched. That radically changed my direction. It was just so deeply wrong, morally, ethically, spiritually, just in the advocacy and protection of children and my care of that realm of life. That is what got me started on the path of studying first the impact of internet pornography. And then as that developed, that field of study, realizing that I wanted to help women, particularly. I do work with men as well, to be fair and clear and honoring of the men I work with. But most of my practice is females that have been betrayed in a primary relationship. not all married. And because I realized that that was the least resourced aspect of this field, is the people being impacted. There was a lot of research and resources for those struggling with compulsive use, but less so for those impacted by a loved one that was doing this in the background. So that was my wake-up call, and that's what got me started years ago.
I certainly empathize with that and understand your journey, because that's what happened with me in family court, right? You know, I'm a divorce coach now. What I experienced personally made me look around and say, this can't be happening. And I decided in my own way to empower and help women. So I am so glad that you started doing this. I know that some studies have even shown that the average age of first exposure is like 12 or 13 years old, or sometimes even younger, right?
Younger.
Or pornography, yeah. Even younger these days.
Even younger. The 11 and 12 year old data is not incorrect. It's just that's what we were seeing probably a decade ago. Now with the continuation of the advent of smartphones. And sadly, and I wish more parents and caregivers would delay the introduction of smartphones, right, or use phones that are not internet enabled, you know, such as the light phone. I'm a big fan of the light phone. There are good devices out there that don't provide this plethora of content that is simply too much to manage for young developing brains. So yes, it has gotten younger. It's not uncommon for us to hear of 7 and 8 being the point of entry for pornography exposure.
Pivoting now to betrayal trauma, I want to explain to people what betrayal trauma is, right? Because some people may say, oh, it's just heartbreak, right? You were cheated on, get over it. How would you address that? How do you explain that to people?
Great question. And I want to validate the misunderstanding. Even in the mental health and medical communities, I want to point out, there remains misunderstanding about this topic. So I'm really grateful for the question. And first, I want to start briefly with the definition of trauma generally. So trauma is a deeply distressing or overwhelming experience that evokes a sense of shock in the mind and body. And if left untreated, it doesn't always have to be treated clinically, but if just left, it can lead to short-term and long-term challenges because we have immediate responses to trauma, you know, shock, hypervigilance, difficulty sleeping, anxiety. And then there's also delayed responses to trauma that a lot of people aren't aware of, you know, that seep in: depression, greater risk-taking, skepticism, shame. So trauma in and of itself is a very broad lens through which to see many experiences that we have, but that the distinction between a highly stressful experience and a traumatic experience is that there's a tripwire crossed in our nervous system that gives us the signal, I can't manage this. This is too much. You know, if we have a stressful day, like, oh, I feel frayed, I'm frazzled, there still is that sense of this is too much, but I can manage this.
Right, right.
With trauma, it crosses a line where we feel helpless, powerless, and it feels too much. I can't do this. I'm drowning in this. So examples of trauma may be a physical assault, witnessing violence, natural disasters. You know, we're familiar with what we would call big T traumas in the clinical field. Betrayal trauma is different in that the very person, as you said in your intro so well, Amy, the very person we expect to trust and have our back the most, when that person ends up being the person that undercuts or calculates against us and betrays our trust in a critical way. So that's really the definition. Is betrayal trauma is when someone we depend on for survival, such as a child to a parent, or are deeply attached to, such as a spouse, violates our trust in a critical way. That then opens the door for the potential of betrayal trauma. So betrayal trauma is not just confined to cheating. It can include things like sexual abuse from a person in authority that we trust or depend on. It can also be an institution. If someone has worked many years, let's say in the military, and they've devoted their life, sacrificed so much, even put their life on the line, literally, for their country, and then they are sexually assaulted in the course of that work, and then the institution doesn't have their back or doesn't believe them, that also constitutes betrayal trauma.
Right. And so we see that in family courts, right? When it is institutional betrayal, that sometimes you have abuse victims who are then, I had a client just this morning dealing with that the judge didn't believe her. The judge was against her in everything she said. And the other attorney was questioning her and calling her a liar. I mean, so she's grappling with betrayal trauma. We see that every day in this world I'm in, obviously, as a divorce coach.
Yes. And what you're highlighting, too, is what I would also call secondary trauma, which is sometimes worse than the primary trauma. Mm-hmm. Because it's like punching a bruise. You know, being punched hurts and it can bruise that soft tissue. But when you punch a bruise, punch something that's already wounded, that gets into a very dangerous territory psychologically. So when someone's reaching out for help, expecting the court, expecting a lawyer, expecting a clergy or someone that they're reaching out for help because they're already in trauma, mm-hmm. when the help traumatizes us, that is secondary trauma. And it is very problematic.
Absolutely. And it's something we wrote about in the book I co-authored, Framed, you know, Women in the Family Court Underworld. We talk about that because these women are in exactly that situation. And then, you know, to add insult to injury, they're often not understood and their behavior is misconstrued in court as, you know, they're not a sympathetic victim because they're suffering through all of this behind the scenes that many of the professionals are not educated in the way you are.
Correct, sadly. And it is not uncommon, Amy, for me to have a colleague or a professional say, Jill, she's crazy. She is like unhinged. And when I hear that very pathologizing language, on one hand, I understand and appreciate what they're saying, sometimes with great urgency, alarm, and care, mm-hmm. right? They're not trying to insult this person always. Some people are being inappropriate, to be clear, but not always. And I think that's where the understanding and education and training mm-hmm. for professionals is so key, because people do appear. And I want to also say to listeners, you can feel like you're going crazy, like you're losing your mind, the racing thoughts, not being able to do your life tasks as you did maybe days or weeks ago. You know, I'm thinking of an example of a woman who was an avid runner, entered marathons, ran daily miles after discovering her spouse was cheating on her through a variety of means. Was not able to run. She was physically able to run, but she'd start hyperventilating and came in thinking, Jill, I'm going crazy. I'm terrified. I can no longer even do the things that I love doing and that we used to be stress releasers for her. Mm-hmm. So it really takes careful handling to know people do feel and sometimes even look like they're in deep, deep distress. And I'm putting in air quotes, this isn't a term I use a lot, but feel like they're going crazy. And that's just it's a symptom and sign that the nervous system is in deep distress and an overwhelmed and needs validation and support quickly. You know, right. Someone that understands what's happening to reassure that person, you are not losing your mind. Your nervous system is on fire and you need safety first.
As someone who has lived through infidelity and betrayal, I know exactly what that feels like. And, you know, sometimes you liken it to the moment you hear, like, the room is kind of like spinning, right? Like your whole world is being called into question. You're trying to piece together all of these different memories and things that have happened to make sense of it. There's that cognitive dissonance. I'm wondering, doctor, if you could explain what actually happens in the body and the brain when someone discovers their partner is betraying them.
Okay, so I'm a great question. I'm going to speak generally, and then I do want to give some nuance to this because sure. situations can be so different. And depending on the mental health status and life circumstances, when this lands in someone's life makes a huge difference as to how their nervous system responds. You know, if someone's already dealing with a different crisis, maybe a loved one's in hospice or a child's dealing with drug addiction or, you know, or right. there's financial stress, their system's already going to be elevated. When right. we learn or discover, and most 85% of people discover, they're not told, they discover a receipt, they discover on a device, for instance, which in and of itself is traumatizing. The way we find out can yes. add to the trauma.
And you never forget it. You never forget it. You always remember that moment.
It's seared, really seared in the brain. And so I just want to lay some context that when and how we find out is very relevant and matters. But generally speaking, when we discover that reality as we knew it, the person we love or married to is not the person we thought he or she was, it is not just stressful. It's what we call primal distress, because we are mammals, we are social beings, and we form attachment. That's how all of us, even very introverted people, rely on social bonds to navigate the world safely, right? Where we say, you're going to be my person, like the buddy system in kindergarten, on the field trip, we each were assigned a buddy. And that's how there was management and containment for that field trip. Well, in life, we do that, the buddy system, call it through relationships. And we say, I choose you and you're choosing me. You're going to be my person and we'll go out into the world. And it's risky and there's stresses, but we'll come home to this safe attachment. And
right. And you have my back
together.
Right. You have my back and I have yours. There's a sense of security. And then it feels like it's blown up, right?
Correct. We're not on our own. When that attachment, when that primary attachment now becomes the source of distress and threat, it is deeply discombobulating. Everything's turned upside down. We question ourselves. We question our doubt, our gut. We don't trust ourselves. We don't trust. I hear a lot of spiritual distress. I don't trust God. How did God protect the secret more than me? Right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot that gets kicked up in the snow globe that gets violently shaken. Mm-hmm. And essentially, in answer to your question, the nervous system goes into a deep fight or flight response. For some, it can go into a deep freeze. Let me explain that a little bit. So a deep fight or flight response is very anxious, hypervigilant, shaky, darty eyes, can't sleep. It's just the nervous system's on fire. With freeze responses, it's almost like a collapse, numb, detached, helpless, can't get out of bed. What's the point of life? It's a very caved in, helpless response, which not that it is a comparison, but the freeze responses are the ones that worry me the most, because they're less likely to reach out for help because they don't feel like help will even be like, what's the point? It doesn't matter. And so some of those people will really stay in this much longer than they should. So those are, and I'm speaking in broad generalities, but that's essentially what happens is it's an injury to the nervous system. It's not an illness. It's right. An injury to the nervous system.
And I think that's so validating.
I hope so, because I think viewing it as an injury is helpful. Many, many people will say, Jill, I waited to get help because I thought this is his mess to clean up. Why am I the one needing help? He's the one that needs help. He's the creep that, the liar, pants on fire that needs to sort this mess out. I get that. I get that line of thinking. However, the analogy that I use is that of a car accident. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to use a personal example if I can, Amy. Years ago, in my early 20s, I was in a 13-car pileup. I'm from Canada. You may detect some of that in my accent and voice.
A little bit, yeah.
I'm not a New Yorker. I was in a 13-car pileup. I was not driving. I was the front passenger. We hit black ice coming home from an event. I was with two friends, and terrifying. I remember that vividly. It was like time slowed down. It felt like we were going through molasses, even though it was like so fast and crunching all the sounds. It's so vividly imprinted in my brain. And I needed help getting out of that vehicle. The accident was not my fault. I was not driving. I was not responsible for the accident, but I still needed help. Mm-hmm. If I had said, well, because I'm not the driver, I don't need help, that would have been a high-risk situation. My back needed medical attention.
Yeah.
Thankfully, in the big scheme of things, I was okay. But I needed chiropractic care for quite a while, and I needed to be seen by a doctor. That's the comparison I use with betrayal trauma. You didn't cause this. You cannot control someone else's behavior, and you're not going to cure whatever mental illness may be driving that. But that does not negate the need to be helped out of that car, to be attended to, and to have that injury cared for. Mm-hmm. So I hope that's a helpful reframe for anyone that may be questioning, I'm not sick, I'm not crazy. No, you're not. And you still deserve quality care. And hopefully by a specialist that understands betrayal and what that does to the nervous system and how to get out of that.
I think that's an excellent analogy. And of course, I'm so glad you're okay after that. You know, I want to ask you, Dr. Manning, how does gaslighting from your partner when you've experienced and discovered betrayal, how does that compound things?
It makes it worse. In fact, in the assessments that we give for betrayed adults, that's one of the things we screen and assess for, because we know from research that the higher the level of denial and gaslighting on the part of the betrayer, and also the degree of blame that is directed at the betrayed, those two factors will exponentially increase the severity of the betrayal trauma. So going back to the car accident analogy for a moment, it's like you've paid for insurance your whole life or adult life. Mm-hmm. And you have that deep sense of hopefully trust that, hey, if something goes south, I can call my insurance company and they've got my back. They're going to help me. They won't make it easy. We all know that. They won't make it easier. Sure. But there's a way, there's backup, right? And that's what allows each of us to go out and drive and live in houses knowing, hey, mm-hmm. we're covered. There's that sense of I've covered. But what happens is if you call the insurance company and they say, we don't believe you, or this accident was all your fault, Jill, we're not going to cover you. Forget it. You're on your own.
Right.
That would now take that accident to a whole other level. You're now dealing with a financial stress and now a double betrayal. Like, hey, I thought you had my back. Mm-hmm. I've paid into this and invested in this for years. And now in the moment I need you most, you don't have my back. That's, I think, a useful metaphor for this is that you've invested in a relationship. You've been vulnerable. You have, in many cases, mortgage, children, you know, finances, trust, vacations, all these, how we give of ourselves to relationships. And then in the moment that we find out that that person is not who we thought they were, and not only that, but they're blaming us for their behavior, or they're twisting our reality to make us try to make us doubt ourselves or question our sanity, that takes it to a whole other level.
That's what I was going to say.
Short, it makes it worse.
Right. Is that, you know, this idea that you feel like you're going crazy when you experience betrayal trauma, your, you know, offender in some cases wants you to doubt yourself. And, you know, when they gaslight you, you do sometimes start to wonder, am I overreacting? Did I imagine this? Maybe it isn't too much of a big deal, even though you might have that hardcore evidence in front of you. You might succumb to that, right? Because I often say to clients, I'm helping post-divorce who've experienced this type of betrayal trauma. It's like, we need to build that back up like a muscle, like going to the gym where, you know, if they decide to date again in the future, and some never want to date again, but some do. And, you know, that you trust your own intuition again, right?
Correct. And one thing I want to point out about gaslighting, I think it is a form of abuse. Let's be clear, right? It is a form of abuse where you are emotionally manipulating someone's reality with the intent of trying to have them act crazy or have them believe they're crazy and losing their minds. And you and I probably, Amy, have countless stories where someone through gaslighting has been really cornered and are doing things out of character, sending texts, behaving or acting in ways that are very histrionic and problematic, even illegal. I've had clients charged or arrested for domestic violence in response to betrayal that does not, I want to be very careful and ethical and clear here. We are responsible for our reactions.
Right.
You know, courts, as you know, don't take kindly to, oh, well, she's been gaslit, therefore we're not going to hold her accountable for X, Y, or Z. So I want to make that clear and upfront. It does not excuse, but it does explain how some people's heightened behaviors and reactions occur. And so unpacking in a nuanced way these stories is really important. And gaslighting is one of the first things in my assessments that I assess for. That's actually in the very first assessment that I administer is questions about that. And in terms of what we do when someone's been in this situation, and really the first step out of gaslighting scenarios too, is establishing safety. That is betrayal trauma care 101. And I really want to stress that to listeners. There's three key phases to how we navigate betrayal, healing. And the first is safety and stabilization. We need to help this person ground their nervous system, kind of get back home to their own gut, take care of themselves. And that can be even the most basic ways, showering, sleeping, eating. You know, when our systems get thrown for a loop, a lot of those things go out the window. So just even slowly, gently helping people come back home to healthy routines, taking care of themselves is so, so key. And also practically building safety. That may be STD testing, getting space, you know, having a brief period of, sometimes not always brief. That's incorrect of me to say that. Getting space, a separation, or just time apart. And slowly customizing with supports, hopefully, a plan for establishing safety. And safety can also include addressing symptoms. You know, if someone's past history with an eating disorder has been inflamed, they're now reactivated in that, or it's activated past traumas with sexual assault, for instance. We need to carefully attend to those things and have the room stop spinning and the bleeding stop before we can do deeper work.
When betrayal ends up in the divorce process, right? As a divorce coach, I tell women all the time, there are three parts of divorce: legal, financial, and emotional. And the emotional is the most important part. And that's one of the key things I do, is to help them keep that in check, get organized, have a strategy, all of those things. And of course, so they're not calling their attorney every day and running up that bill. But I'm wondering, how do you think betrayal trauma affects a woman's ability to make good decisions in a divorce?
It complicates it incredibly. And that's why resources and helps like yourself, and you know that I refer to you in the good work you. That you're doing, to just those trusted, safe supports to help steady us and be a check and a sounding board are so critically important, because all of us, I'm not singling anyone out, I'm including myself front and center. Any of us, when we are in a fight or flight or freeze response in the nervous system, we don't have clarity of mind, not because we're not intelligent or capable, but just the state of the nervous system and the stress level and trauma affects our ability to think clearly. Also, it hinders our ability to think long-term and futuristically. So those long-term choices that we may be making in a divorce process, for instance, can be very negatively impacted if we are still in a very highly active trauma state. So establishing safety, getting grounded in the gut, identifying trusted supports, which you and I both know sometimes is quite a process in and of itself. We tell our story to the wrong person. We know in a hurry, okay, I really regret that. This person is not helpful. It takes a while to get our tribe around us, yes, right, that has our back and has our best interest at heart. It's just so needed. I don't believe anyone heals or recovers in isolation. And I'm saying that as an introvert. That's really a statement, right? None of us, including myself, heal in isolation. So those supports are key so that we can make sound decisions and be making decisions that don't prematurely cut off resources, finances, or just long-term things that are in our best interest.
Absolutely. Just this week, I did a video on social media about women I see often in these different Facebook groups who say, I need a shark attorney. You know, maybe they've discovered betrayal and they are like, I need one right away. And it can be a huge, huge mistake because they're rushing in based on emotion, wanting perhaps a little revenge, which we can all empathize with but they're not educating themselves. They're not looking at what is the best choice for me. They're not understanding our family court system or how it works. And sadly, I see some of these women end up with huge, huge legal bills, and it's not going anywhere. It's the wrong process or attorney who just wants to perpetuate conflict. So it's really key, because I became a divorce coach because I made some emotional choices and mistakes that I still live with in my divorce degree. Mm-hmm. Every day, right? So that's been my passion, is to help other women and prevent them from making those decisions. You know, when it comes to the healing, Dr. Manning, it can be a long road, right? I mean, this isn't something overnight. You know, you watch a few videos, you read a book, and you snap your fingers, and where you might have family and friends who haven't experienced this say, oh, he cheated or she cheated, it's done, get over it, move on.
Exactly. Boy, there's so much I have to say on this topic, so I'll try to be succinct. Getting specialized help is really key. You know, if we have a heart condition, we want to see a cardiologist. Mm-hmm. You know, we want someone that has had that nuanced, credible, rigorous training to help us in the most nuanced, specific way possible. So I'm a really big advocate in specialized help. And if people are not aware, APSATS.org is a website that contains a directory, for international directory for betrayal trauma specialists. That's APSATS.org.
I'll put that in the show notes also.
So I try to shout that out so people, you know, where whatever state or area they're living in, can have a way to access that directory for specialized care. But the healing process, you know, the three phases: safety and stabilization. The second is processing. The third is reconnection and moving forward. What I find often is people come in eager and wanting to get into processing right away. And processing involves, why did this happen? How could he do this? Am I staying or am I leaving? Just like we just spoke about minutes ago, we can't do effective, wise, grounded processing, which includes grief work, the deeper trauma work, decision making, when our nervous system is on fire or shut down. Right. So having that guidance, someone that knows the roadmap and understands what's happening to your nervous system, is so key, so that people can be first nurturing and caring of themselves, but also, using your word, strategic too. And I don't mean that to sound so calculating, but when someone's in a relationship with someone that's deceptive,
yes,
or narcissistic, this is a whole other layer to this that really takes careful thought and guidance, because there are things that will be used against her often, you know, in court, for instance, the screenshots of texts that are like reaming him out, shaming him, name calling. So someone with specialized skills to say, look, you matter, you're valuable, you deserve care and care and healing is possible. But there's an order of operations here. We're not going to be able to get to those big decisions until your nervous system is stabilized. And just, that's one of the things I find people most relieved to hear. Oh, there's a roadmap, there's a sequence. And just even knowing that is so key. One thing, though, that I do run into a lot is people will underestimate the length of the healing process.
Yeah.
Typically, and there's lots of individual outliers and exceptions, I realize. Typically, I see this as a 2 to 5 year process. I hope that that sounds validating to the depth of this pain for those that are listening, that this isn't going to be a handful of sessions or just a few months. This, when you're dealing with primal distress and your whole world has been thrown for a loop, there's a lot of layers to this. So it is a process, but it's a doable process, and it's not equally intense the whole time. You know, someone's often not seeing a therapist regularly that entire time, but they may be doing things like 12-step or meeting with a doctor occasionally, things like that. You know, there's a lot that can go into that. But I think I'd most want listeners to know healing is possible. And in fact, there's research showing that in the majority of cases, that people will grow and be more resilient after a trauma. I think that's a very hopeful message.
Yeah,
it doesn't mean we're grateful for the trauma. That doesn't mean we wish that on people. But as a hopeful message, this is something people can overcome and often be wiser and stronger in the end with the right guidance and help.
Right. And I think the more people see on social media. I love your social media posts. I often share them because I feel like they're so good. And I run a support group called Strong Savvy Women, which is a free Facebook group. I think the more you surround yourself with other women's stories, for example, you say, all right, they've gotten through this, right? Like I have women in my group who are 10 years out from the trauma, giving advice a little bit and cheering on those who are thinking of leaving. So thank you for that. I just want to move on to a segment we have here on Girl Wake Up called Truth or Trap. And it's a societal statement that maybe we've heard before thrown around. And I would love for you to react to it and tell me if you think it's truth or trap and why. Pornography use in a relationship is harmless as long as there's no physical cheating.
Oh, Amy, you've opened up a Pandora's box. Okay, that is definitely
don't hang
a trap.
Up on me.
That is definitely a trap. And I say that from a research perspective and as a clinician of, you know, over 26 years now. That is such a big myth and it's a lie. This idea that it's harmless. Pornography is digital prostitution. Mm-hmm. It's a form of exploitation. It's often showing trafficked individuals. Yes. Minors. It's often glorifying and eroticizing illegal acts such as incest, rape. In fairness, because I want to be accurate with the science, not all pornography contains those themes, but we know from research that the majority of it does. And secretive pornography use has been shown in studies of wide numbers of people to be considered and be experienced as a form of cheating, where someone's taking sexual energy and turning that outside of the relationship,
right,
and often being deceptive or withholding of information around it. Even when I encounter clients that use this mutually, and they'll say, look, I engaged in this with my partner. I thought this, I was being so modern and evolved and a really cool, you know, a cool gal by doing this with my partner. This gets into neurobiology. And what I mean by that is, you do not know how this is affecting the brain and nervous system of someone else. And even if you think that's a mutual activity, this can so easily jump track in the background and become something that is compulsive. In a nationally representative study that was cited in the 2018 JAMA journal, 10% of adults in the US, males, 10% of males have compulsive sexual issues. 7% of females. So that's another myth. A lot of people think we do know that men use pornography more often, more frequently, tend to look at more violent material than females. But the difference between 10 and 7 is not, that's 3% difference in the number of people that are struggling with compulsive behavior. So the rate of compulsivity and addiction has tripled in the last 20 years. Pornography, we know, increases the risk of divorce by 200%, and that does not even have to be at an addictive level to do so. And time again in studies that I track, if you look at all the factors, religion, age, gender, culture, you look at all of those pieces, time and time again, the research shows that pornography leads to dissatisfaction in relationships and does not have good outcomes for health, connection, intimacy, and sexuality. So yeah, that is definitely a trap.
You've made your point. I often get very disturbed by reports of, you know, more partners thinking strangulation is a normal part of sexual intimacy. I mean, and it goes back to watching pornography and the glorification of that, right?
Yes, that is a common theme in today's modern pornography. And this is where I would ask listeners and ourselves, Amy, to really clarify our own sexual ethics and values. So for instance, and I will own this, this is my own sexual ethic. I view and believe that sexuality is a life force. It is to be enriching, life-giving, life-producing. Mm-hmm. It is to enhance life. And I do not, in my personal ethics, believe that our sexual behavior or feelings are ever to harm another person, including ourselves.
Right.
So if someone is not clear on their own personal values and stance, and I do not believe anyone has to hold my same belief or view of that. But what I invite people is to clarify their own.
Right.
And when they are in a relationship, to hold on to that as a really important metric and anchor of, does this behavior line up with my personal values? In my gut, does this feel right? Do I like this? Does this scare me? Or do I feel pressured to go outside my value set? And if the answer is yes to any of that, I really, really encourage men and women to slow down, stop, and really question and ask good questions about pornography use and about the health of the relationship. What are they going along? Are they going along to get along? Why? What's the cost of that? Right. And so there's strangulation, just matter of factly, has real danger associated with it. Right. It's a dangerous behavior.
I think that's an excellent point that everyone should take time to think about that. And that's a great segue into our listener letter. And this is from someone in my support group who says, "Hi, Dr. Manning, I found things on my partner's phone that he insists are harmless, including pornography. But ever since, I feel unsettled and constantly on edge. I keep questioning myself, like maybe I'm the problem for not being okay with it. He keeps saying I'm overreacting. Is he right, Mary?" And I'm guessing you would say, well, what are your personal feelings? Like, let's put you first, right? I mean, not him and what he's saying. And there's some gaslighting involved here too, right?
Definitely. Now, there's lots I know what you just shared. So there's lots of variables there, but I would be, it's concerning. And that letter concerns me because it is so common, sadly, where people start questioning themselves and think, am I overreacting? Am I a prude? And that's part of the gaslighting, in my view, this pornification in our culture that is so harmful, especially to women. It's harmful to men as well, to be clear. Mm-hmm. I there's so much I could say, Amy. I'm trying to choose what's most important to share here. So no, that this individual, this woman is not overreacting, and I'd want her to really value what her gut and her system is telling her and pay very close attention to how her partner is responding to her concerns, questions, or reactions. If she's being dismissed, put down, invalidated, that is a red flag, not just about pornography, but about the relationship health overall. Because what we know is that pornography is not an isolated behavior. Mm-hmm. I see the pornography use as a symptom, not as the cause issue. Mm-hmm. You know, it is easy for all of us to confuse a crisis with the problem. And when you discover something on someone's phone, that can feel like a crisis. Like, what is going on? What else is he doing? What else is he hiding from me? You know, is this what he's attracted to? I don't look anything like that. What, you know, it throws into our self-esteem, self-concept. And who is this guy? Who is this partner? Right. There's a lot that gets kicked up. And so I encourage people to slow down and honor what their system's telling us. In most cases, Amy, especially when pornography use has become compulsive, we know that up to 75%, there's one or more mental health conditions driving that. Mm. So this often is a mental health issue.
Right.
Not just a behavioral habit. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah,
this
is just the tip of the iceberg.
Driven by something. Yeah. So misogyny, entitlement, narcissism, depression. We know that there's a disproportionate number of men who are sexually compulsive have been sexually abused themselves, mm-hmm. where this is a reenactment of their own betrayal trauma, often as youngsters. Not an excuse, but my point here in response to that listener's the letter you read is, there's more to that story than just what was found on that screen.
Absolutely.
And I'd want her to trust herself and get support to help navigate, how do I establish safety? And if my partner is just a brick wall and not accepting influence, what are my options and choices? But that it's a red flag. And no, she's not underreacting. And any form of exploitation or secretive behavior is problematic in a relationship. What I say to my clients is, the only type of secret in a relationship that is appropriate is what I call a benevolent secret, the hiding of a birthday gift, A benevolent secret is something that is hidden that benefits the person in the end and that will be known at some point. Other than benevolent secrets, there's really no room for that in healthy, secure relationships.
Excellent point. And, you know, the last thing I'll say, and I've written about this as a journalist, is, you know, women are raising their standards these days. And many of them are saying, I mean, you read the articles too, they're forming momunes and communes and living together or home with their dogs and cats, and they're perfectly happy. And they're saying, you know what, if I can't have an honest relationship with no secrets, where I am treated respectfully, being alone or having my most important relationships be family and friends. So I think we're seeing women become more educated and putting themselves first, which is a great thing to see. And, you know, as the mom of a 17-year-old son, you know, I think there are a lot of good men out there. I want to be clear, right?
Yes, I love men, and I've been very fortunate to have some virtuous, strong, very noble men in my own life. I believe pornography is with men. I think it's insulting, insulting to women in different ways. But I'm glad people are becoming more educated and raising the bar on what they're expecting and needing. We hear more and more in the news the struggle young men are having, you know, with loneliness too. And I don't often hear enough mention and referencing of what big a factor pornography is in the mental health struggles of young men, young women as well. There is a growing number of young women struggling with this as well. But to your point, yes, I fully encourage and support women in holding that line and holding a firm boundary around a porn-free home and a porn-free relationship. Pornography is what's abnormal. We are not wired for pixels. We are wired to connect and be intimate.
Right. We're wired for human connection.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Yes. And so there's, I want women to be protected and wise and savvy and hold that high for themselves and for their children and for their relationships.
It's a great place to end. How can people find you who want to know more about your work?
Sure. Well, and thank you for this forum today. It's such an important topic. I can be found up at my website, www.drjillmanning.com, on Instagram, Dr. Jill Manning. And those websites and page give all the other information of how to reach me.
Thanks for listening to Girl Wake Up. I'm your host, Amy Polacco. If this episode woke something up in you, don't let it fade. Share it with a friend who needs to hear it, leave a review, and keep this conversation going. Remember, no one's coming to save you. So she did.